How do you do? Jen and Cam feel it would be unkind to present this program without a friendly word of warning. We are about to unfold our true crime podcast, a podcast of lifelong friends who seek to examine crimes which were committed without reckoning upon God. The discussion will be frank, and the subject matter will be of a grim and violent nature. I think it will thrill you. It might even horrify you. So, if there are young children listening, or if you feel unwilling to subject your nerves to such a strain, now is your chance to... Well, we've warned you.
Hi, Jen.
Hey, how are you?
I am quarantined. How are you?
Hey, me too.
Really? I thought it was
me. Huh. I know. But anyway, we're not going to talk about that. Nope. Everything is fine and dandy in the world.
Nope, it's not. But that's okay. That's where we come in.
We are living in our own personal nirvana.
It's not the word I'd choose, but okay.
Everything's better when you pretend.
All right, Jen. So I hear you got a case for us today.
Well, I don't have a case. We have another listener-written episode.
Ooh.
This one is from Megan Miller.
Megan! We know Megan. Well,
we know
Megan. We know her mom.
I don't think we went to high school with her mom. Her mom was the mother of all of our group when we hung out.
Yeah, she was.
Wasn't she?
Yeah,
always
totally.
Making us food and taking care of us when we might have drank too much soda, got an upset tummy.
That's right. Yeah. Oink, oink. Yep.
Uh-huh.
She would hold your hair.
Right.
Let's put it that way.
All right. Are we ready to dive into this?
I am ready. Let's go.
All right. I'm going to read it exactly as Megan wrote it.
I'm excited for Megan. This is cool for her.
I know.
I would
be
cool.
It's awesome.
Yeah.
At one point, she said something about doing her own podcast.
Maybe this
I haven't heard.
Maybe this is her sticking her little toe in the water to see.
Exactly.
You know.
Well, today's episode is entitled The Meanest Man in America, Donald Pee-wee Gaskins. And there is, of course, content warning in our episode. Pee-wee was not the nicest man, hence the title, The Meanest Man.
I gathered that from the title.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Donald Henry Gaskins, better known as Pee-wee, was born in rural South Carolina in March of 1933. He was born to an unwed mother who bounced around from man to man, and most of them treated Donald very harshly. His mother did not treat Donald so well either. It is said that he didn't even know his real name until he was charged with his first petty crime and went to court.
Really?
That's what it's saying here. When Donald was young, his mother met a man whom she married. The pair would often have sex in front of Donald. You know, if you want to do it in front of other people, that's fine. But your own child? Really?
And yeah, you don't think they're going to be a little bit messed up?
Thank you. Thank you. Mm. He would try to make them stop, but they would just laugh at him and push him away and just continue to have sex.
That's awful.
Molly, Donald's mother, would often have sex for very little amounts of money with men around town. Many of these men were alcoholics and would sexually assault Donald while she watched. She even married someone who was abusive towards Donald. Donald was a small boy, obviously, with the nickname Pee-wee. You would just assume that. But because of this, he was often made fun of and beat up in school. And, of course, teachers blamed Donald for how the other kids treated him, and he often received beatings from not only his peers, but his teachers as well. Donald would eventually hide out in the forest behind the school just to get away from the other children. At age 11, Donald dropped out of school to work as a mechanic for a garage.
I was going to say, let's just think about that. In today's world, we're an 11-year-old, so that's what, like a fifth grader, sixth grader, drops out of school. And goes to a place and says, can I have a job? And they're like, sure, 11-year-old boy. Come on in.
Mm-hmm.
That's...
Yeah. Donald was known for being a handyman, and he often fixed broken toys, fans, and other household appliances. It was here that Donald met his friends Danny and Marsh, who also had dropped out of school. Shortly after they met, Donald, Danny, and Marsh began a crime spree involving breaking into homes and stealing big-ticket items, like radios and such, and sell them for a profit. They committed several burglaries together and called themselves the Trouble Trio. You know, it's never good to give yourself names.
No. Yeah. Mm-mm.
The group also began soliciting the services of prostitutes. This is how Donald described them in his book. But as we all know, sex workers is the better term for the job. The Trouble Trio became increasingly violent around this time as they were becoming bored with stealing and hiring the sex workers. They started to rape young boys and threatened to kill them if they went to the police. These antics led to a particularly heinous act of violence against one of their own family members. And this is before they were 13.
Something.
So at age 13, Donald found an abandoned shack in the woods where the group would hang out and engage in illicit activities. It was here that the three concocted a horrendous plan. Marsh had a younger sister, Julie, who was 13 at the time. The boys decided it would be exciting to gang rape her.
Oh.
They brought Julie to the shack. They proceeded to rape her for an hour, raping her in as many ways as they could think of. They did this until they physically couldn't do it anymore. Once they let Julie go, she immediately told her parents, who informed the two other boys' parents. Donald, Marsh, and Danny received brutal beatings from Donald's stepfather.
Ooh.
Can't say I'm upset about that.
I can't either. Sorry, buddy.
Hope they beat him till they bleed. Anyway, the boys were stripped naked and hung by their feet to be beaten. While being beaten, something strange happened to Donald. While he was being whipped, Donald got an erection. Donald's stepfather was enraged by this, calling him a sicko, and started beating him even harder. When asked later about his first violent sex experience, Donald described it as being a very fulfilling part of his life. Shortly after, the families of Danny and Marsh moved away, which split up the Troubled Trio forever. In 1948, Donald met another partner, Walt, at a car shop. Shortly after meeting, they concocted a plan to break into homes and sell the stolen goods for profit. So, you know, pretty much what he was doing before, but with a different guy. During one of Donald and Walt's heists, they broke into a house that was not empty. They didn't know it wasn't empty. A 16-year-old girl was home, and she attacked Donald with a hatchet. Once she realized that two men were robbing her family, Donald was able to get the hatchet away from the girl and hit her very hard in the head with it, rendering her unconscious. Walt was luckily able to get away from the robbery untouched. However, Donald was charged with assault with a deadly weapon and intent to kill. It was during this trial that Donald first learned that his name was really Donald Henry Gaskin and not Pee-wee.
So strange to me that like a parent wouldn't tell him or somebody what's your real name, you know?
Right, that he would be over like 13.
Yeah.
Yeah. But I guess it's South Carolina and everybody goes with by nicknames anyway.
I guess.
You might not put it together. Donald was found guilty and was sent to the South Carolina Industrial School for Boys in Florence, South Carolina. Donald first went to reform school in 1950. And the first night he spent at the school, Donald was approached by Boss Haas, who was one of the main leaders at the school. Haas informed Donald that he would be his sweetheart from now on, and was told to go to Haas's bed each night or else.
Oh.
That's good. The following evening, when Donald didn't obey, Haas and about 20 of his followers ambushed him in the shower, raping and sodomizing him. They held him down and forced a penis into his mouth, and then they proceeded to rape him for the next several hours. During Donald's first year at reform school, he was Boss's sweetheart. Well, because he was forced to. I wouldn't exactly call
him. So he did succumb to all that, right? Like he finally, I guess, just, yeah, because he's going to get beat up every night.
And raped. I mean, Boss would rape Donald every night without fail. He would also trade Donald in exchange for cigarettes, forcing him to endure being raped by several others at the school. So he was basically being pimped out at this point.
Where are the people? Where's the administrators? You can't... You can't.
1950s?
Yeah, you know that they knew what was going on. You know it.
I'm sure they did. But it's no excuse for what he did later in his life.
Well, no. But, no, but that might have lent to it, you know, that mm-hmm. that's all you ever know.
After almost a year of sexual and emotional abuse at the reform school, Donald and four other boys, who were also raped by Poss and his followers, ran away from the school. The next day, the police picked up the boys while they were hiding in the woods, so I guess they didn't get very far. When the officers weren't looking, Donald managed to run away again. He ran to his old clubhouse he used to share with Marsh and Danny. He was found 2 days later and was given lashes, 3 months of hard labor, and 3 months solitary confinement as punishment for running away. Although Donald hated solitary confinement because he liked to socialize, as we do, and we all know how confinement is feeling right now.
Oh, it's terrible.
He was not beaten or raped by Poss and the other boys. Good. So this was almost like a vacation for Donald, and he took that with great appreciation. When Donald was let out of solitary confinement, the rape by Poss and his followers began every day again. Once they forced Donald to run around the school in girls' underwear, Donald just couldn't handle the abuse anymore.
I don't blame him.
It was then that he decided to run away from the school, but this time he was only taking one other boy, just to assure that he could get away free.
Hmm.
After escaping, Donald went to his aunt's house and she agreed to let him stay, if only he stayed out of trouble. And, of course, help around the house.
Nope.
It was the first time Donald felt he had a mother figure in his life. After about 3 months, Donald's aunt convinced him to turn himself in and finish his sentence at the reform school so he would not have to live a life on the run, which just can't be easy.
I don't know. Neither of them sound very easy.
Don't do the crime. Don't do the time. Once Donald arrived back at the reform school, he was again given solitary confinement and hard labor. Almost every day, the guards would find ridiculous reasons to give Donald additional lashes. One day, after being punished for no reason by a guard, Donald punched the guard in the face and then again in the testicles.
Ooh.
After this, Donald was sent to the state hospital for a mental evaluation. It's kind of a little late, if you tell me. He was only in the mental hospital for one day when his appendix ruptured, and then he was sent to a medical hospital. After treatment, Donald was sent back to the reform school once again and given light duty for 3 months. Immediately after light duty had ended, the guards and Poss beat and raped Donald every day until he once again ran away, This time all by himself. He wanted to make sure that he could escape and that he would stay gone, unlike the last few times. So while he was an escapee from the reform school once again, Donald met a girl named Mary. They were shortly married.
Don't do it, Mary. Don't do it.
Mm-hmm. Well, they did. They got married. And not long after they got married, Donald turned himself back into the reform school to finish out his sentence so he and his new wife would not have to live life on the run. It was either that or he really regretted getting married and he would perform life. At age 18, Donald was released from reform school. Donald went to live with Mary, where they lived with Mary's family. He got a job at a construction site and began doing some shade tree repair on the weekends. Not even sure what shade tree repair is.
Like trimming trees?
Trimming back,
I guess.
Like an arborist of some sort. An arborist?
Sure.
Around this time, Mary became pregnant, because of course, and they moved to Georgetown, South Carolina to live with family. Some more family of Mary's. While there, Donald got a government contract job to log cypress trees in the swamps. They lived there for a few months until Slick, one of Donald's friends from reform school, offered Donald and Mary to work for him on his tobacco farm. This offer included housing in a 3-bedroom house in Jacksonville, South Carolina, and a pickup truck. The offer was just too good to pass up. So the job on the tobacco farm is not what one would expect. Have you ever been to a tobacco field?
I have not.
Any chance? When I was in 8th grade, my cousins up in Canada worked tobacco farms.
Canada? Yeah, tobacco Canada. Farm?
Yeah, it is. That's not fun work. Let's put it that way.
They
would always be like sticky and tarry and blech. Donald and Slick began burning tobacco fields for money, committing insurance fraud. That's probably a lot better than actually working in the tobacco
field. I would think so.
Field.
Definitely easier, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Slick was quickly arrested for arson, but didn't turn Donald in, as he and Mary had just had a baby girl. Someone else gained control over the tobacco fields, but allowed Mary and Donald to stay. When the new owner took over, his daughter harassed Donald and informed him that they would turn him in because they knew he was involved in the fires. So to shut the girl up, as Donald could, he hit her with a hammer and rendered her unconscious. He took off so that he wouldn't get arrested. However, he was picked up a few days later and was charged with assault with a deadly weapon with intent to inflict bodily harm and or arson for setting the barns and fields on fire. I guess they finally did get him for the arson. Donald was sentenced to 5 years in the South Carolina State Penitentiary in Columbia for the charges. While in court, he called the judge a son of a bitch and was given an additional year.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's not going to go over so well.
I'm starting to think Pee-wee might have a little of that short man syndrome, which not all men of small stature have, mind you.
Oppositional defiant disorder.
Yes, but I'm thinking Pee-wee's got loads of it.
What he doesn't have in height, makes up for it in anger.
Maybe. Yes. So while in prison, Donald was once again subjected to beatings and rape due to his size. Now, Donald knew that he needed to do something to make him seem tough so that no one would mess with him again, which is smart, I guess.
Question mark.
Donald came up with a plan to kill Hazel Brazell, the most powerful man in the prison at the time. So one day, Donald snuck into Hazel's cell and stabbed him, making him, of course, die. And Donald was sentenced to another 3 years in prison. When he was released, he was now known and considered to be a powerful man by the other inmates. And he was given his own inmate to beat and rape. Do they just hand those out?
Is that a thing?
You have to find them.
Wow. Huh.
I don't know. But Donald said that he always went easy on the boy because he knew what it was like to be an underdog. I'm guessing what she means there is, since he was the biggest big man on campus, I guess, that the followers picked human sacrifice to Donald, maybe?
I guess. Wow.
In 1955, Donald hatched an elaborate plan to escape from prison using the prison's garbage system. He and a few other inmates climbed into the trash bins that were going out of the prison, burying themselves in the trash, which they did successfully escape. Once outside the prison, he walked through a forest to his cousin David Gaskin's home, where he stole his cousin's car. He then went to visit his own reform school buddy, Poss.
See? Okay,
I think
never
it's
mind.
Stockholm syndrome type
just
thing?
Just a little weird, yes.
He felt safe with Poss, like he did
things
for Poss, and Poss kept him safe, even though he was abusive.
I guess. I don't know. It's just odd.
Donald traveled with Poss and the carnival for quite some time. It was there that he met his second wife, Junie. Now, even though he was still married to Mary, he married Junie anyway.
Mm-hmm.
But divorced no more than 2 weeks later. So I don't even think that could be considered that they were really married, so it'd be easy to divorce, I guess.
That was a sleepover, is what that was.
Exactly. He met another girl, Betty Jean, at a girly show, which, you know, one of those peep shows, strip club type things.
Mm-hmm.
Betty Jean was working the girly show at the carnival.
Did carnivals have girly shows? I guess they did.
Mm-hmm. Depends on what kind of carnival. They drove together to Cookeville, Tennessee to bail Betty's brother out of jail. When they arrived in the city, Betty disappeared, leaving Donald alone. The man in jail was not her brother, but her husband.
Oh.
Betty Gates, like most women in his life, had let Donald down with lies and cheating. The police in Tennessee quickly realized that Donald was an escaped convict and he was returned to prison. Donald was paroled in 1962. Donald married for the third and fourth time, finding that monogamy was not something he was interested in.
Apparently.
Uh-huh. With his latest wife, only 17.
I always say that, like, and there's nothing wrong with it. Kudos to you. But people that get married several times, and I think, how can you, don't you kind of want to turn around and be like, why has this person been married four times? Like, is it me? Is it them? Do you see what I'm saying? Like, something's not right. You know what I mean?
Well, chances are it's them. I mean, that's just the...
Well, and then he targets a 17-year-old. I mean, come on.
Donald's fourth wife was only 17, and she turned him into authorities for statutory rape. So you know that that was...
What? Who turned him in?
His last wife, his fourth wife.
The 17-year-old.
Mm-hmm. Turned in her husband for statutory rape.
But she married him.
Mm-hmm.
Does she not know how that works?
I think she probably hated him so much that that's how to get out of the relationship. She turned him in for statutory rape.
Okay, because I was a little perplexed there. Okay.
Yeah. So he ended up going to the Columbia Penitentiary and served some time there and then was paroled once again in 1968. So I'm kind of seeing a little habit here. We go into jail or reform school. We come out. We get married a couple times. After being released from prison, Donald married again.
Of course he did. What is he up to now? Is this number five?
Five, I think. This time he played it smart and married somebody of age. She was 18-year-old Jerry Dolores.
Of age? That's a year older than the other one.
But she's 18. She's 18.
Oh,
that's all that matters.
I guess.
At this point, he went back to robbing and stealing goods. Oh, and he was also living with his mom.
Again, this goes back to, and I don't mean any, you know, there's, God bless you if you can find people that you love enough to marry again and again and again. At what point didn't an 18-year-old go, now this guy's a catch. He's been in prison a couple times. He's been out a couple times. He's been married a couple times. And he lives with his mom. I want him.
Well, you know what? You would think, well, gosh, I'm his fifth wife. He must have this married thing down, right?
No, I would think no. He needs, at 18, needs to go to reform school for marriage and figure that out.
But I love him, Daddy. I love him. Around this time, Donald begins to take notice of a girl. Mm-hmm. This girl, 12 years old. Mm. Her name's Patsy. She lived close by his mother. In early September of that year, Donald molested her. And what happened? He was taken to Florence County Jail, where he was charged with statutory rape and carnal knowledge of a child. Damn. Carnal knowledge, that used to be a really good movie. Remember? Carnal
knowledge, totally, but they don't even use that term anymore, do they? Is that a term people use? I don't think it is.
Not in everyday language, no.
Mm-mm. I had carnal knowledge of that man, Jen.
Mm-hmm. While at the Florence County Courthouse, a deputy removed Donald's handcuffs while he waited for his attorney and prosecutor. Donald seized this opportunity and escaped by jumping 30 feet out of a window that was in the bathroom. So after jumping 30 feet out of the bathroom window, he stole a county car that still had the keys in the ignition. What the heck? Donald proceeded to go to his mother's house to get money and then headed out to Prospect, South Carolina. He soon ditched the car in some water off the highway and started walking on foot towards the town of Dillon. Once in Dillon, Donald stole a 1962 Ford Galaxy. And the following day, he crossed the state line into North Carolina and the Lumbee Indian Reservation in Pembroke. That's where he took shelter in a boarding house. The next day, he drove the stolen car to Charlotte, North Carolina, where he dumped it and caught a bus back to Raleigh. Once in Raleigh, he bought a 1949 Ford and drove back to Pembroke.
What?
Donald, I know.
No wonder he keeps ending up in jail.
I know. At this time, Donald gets married once again.
Of course he does.
This time to a 17-year-old Lumbee girl, Lenny Oxidine.
Oh, Lenny's a cute name for a girl.
Mm-hmm. Only, and this is surprising, but after only 3 months of marriage,
no,
he had grown tired of the married life, and Donald informed Lenny that he was going to go to the store, but instead, he left and never came back.
Oh, the old, I'm going to go get cigarettes and I'll be back later trick. I fell for that.
She should have turned him in for statutory rape like his other wife. But I digress. Donald went back to his last wife, Jerry, and begged for her forgiveness. Jerry was reluctant due to the recent molestation of the 12-year-old girl, Patty,
which I
can understand that. And, you know, Donald had already left her once, but she agreed.
What is wrong with people? People, you're better than this.
Donald decided he wanted to make his way to Lake Wales, Florida, to meet with his old friend, Poss. I'm thinking Donald has some serious feelings for Poss.
I have something.
However, once he arrived, he was met with terrible news that Poss had committed suicide after his wife and four children died in a fire in their trailer.
Oh.
This meant that Donald no longer had a job secured with the carnival. At this point, Donald's wife, Jerry, was feeling desperate and afraid of what the future may or may not hold. So she decided she no longer wanted to be with a man on the run.
Okay.
Donald decided he wanted to go back and find Lenny because
he cannot be by himself. Pee-wee, maybe that's part of the problem, buddy. He needs a self-help group.
I know, but let me, being the gentleman that Donald is, he has decided and agreed to drive Jerry back home first. Right. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So as they crossed the state Georgia line, they heard sirens behind them, causing Donald to get into a police chase. The car blew a tire and crashed into a marsh. And that's where Donald, being the ever so gentleman that he is, left Jerry to drown.
Are you kidding?
Luckily, she escaped the car and was picked up by the police, but was soon released with no charges. Wow. Donald did successfully evade law enforcement by hiding in the marsh. They actually thought that he had drowned. Donald then walked until he found train tracks, jumped on a freight train heading towards Savannah, and then slept all the way there. In Savannah, Donald got himself some new clothes and caught a bus back to Pembroke, North Carolina, with the intention of going back to see Lenny once again.
You think she'd have anything to do with him at this point?
You'd hope not. But he seems to find the women that, I don't know.
Mm-hmm. I got you. You don't need to say anything, Jen. Mm-hmm. I got you. I know what's up.
When he showed up on Lenny's doorstep, she was not at all pleased to see him. In fact, when she saw the story on the news of, quote, the serial killer that may have drowned in the marsh.
Oh.
She called the police and told him that said serial killer was in her house.
Mm. Mm-hmm. I don't know if that's going to end well for her.
So while Donald was taking a nap, he was kind of shocked when he woke up to a sheriff handcuffing him. Mm-hmm. He was taken to the county jail in Florence, and Donald was sentenced to 6 years in prison, but he was soon released after 4 years because of good behavior. So, wow, listen to this. Donald managed to stay out of trouble for a while.
A week?
Mm-hmm. It's after he was released for good behavior. He picked up a job working for the construction company, and he was pretty busy. He had his hands full. So it wasn't until the summer of 1968 that this, quote, bothersome feelings, a.k.a. his murderous urges, began to resurface. And at this time, it came back with a vengeance.
Uh-oh.
Donald described his, quote, bothersome pain as starting at his testicles, then traveling up his spine, through his stomach, and finally settling in his head and behind his eyes, giving him intense migraines.
You know, he probably should have had that looked at. That's also a sign of testicular cancer.
And that's when he said, quote, the voice would appear. He stated that this voice would urge him to commit horrendous acts. Really? Is that your conscience? Donald hated women, as we can tell. But more specifically, he hated women because of the way he was treated by them in his past. He had such a pent-up rage towards any and all women that he just needed to let it out. This was around the time that Donald started to ride along the coastal highway from Myrtle Beach to Savannah, looking for female hitchhikers that would satisfy his need to take away this, quote, bothersome pain.
Let me just say right here, okay, if he has such a hatred towards women, he kept going back to his mother's house, number one. Number two, he found, six more women than he should have to marry him or be with him, okay? So really, his pent-up energy, to me, should go back to when he was molested by the boys at the reform school and the officers that looked the other way. Okay, let me get off my soapbox now. Okay, I'm good.
Okay, my whole uneducated guess is that the pain that all these women caused them are simply the fact that they are women and not men. I think the Pee-wee might have been gay and being at the time couldn't do anything. So that's what my uneducated guess is. I could be wrong. God knows I have been in the past, but
at least
that's what I'm thinking.
At least you went past fifth grade, unlike Pee Wee. Okay, go ahead.
In September 1969, Donald picked up a blonde female hitchhiker who used the name Angie, but he picked her up in Pawleys Island. So while they drove, Donald propositioned Angie for sex, to which she responded by laughing at that and rejecting him.
That's not going to be good, Angie. Nope. Annie.
Of course, Donald was beyond furious at her rejection, and he beat Angie unconscious. Donald then proceeded to rape Angie, both vaginally and anally. However, raping her was not enough to satisfy his urges. His fantasy of torture was too powerful for this bothersome pain to be dulled. What's a man to do? He bit off her nipples, stomped on her pelvic bone, and slid an 8-inch dagger into her rectum, pulling it towards her vagina until it sliced through and made a gaping hole.
Oh my God.
A self-episiotomy, I guess.
Oh.
Or a home episiotomy. When recounting this murder in his memoir, The Final Truth, he wrote, "All I could think about is how I could do anything I wanted to her."
Okay,
that gave me the shivers. Seriously, I don't get full body chills, but I get the shivers. And that gave me the shivers. At this point, Angie was still somehow clinging to life. Donald.
Come on, Angie. I hope she makes it.
So Donald realized he needed to kill her. He found some heavy rocks, hogtied her to a branch, and dropped her in a quicksand-like marsh where she quickly sank.
That's awful.
Before he left, he stole what little money she had, tossed the rest of her belongings in behind her, and drove away. After this murder, Donald realized that he really liked killing people and that it really satisfied his needs. A mere 6 weeks after the first murder, Donald heard, quote, the voice telling him to kill again. He would do so much in the same way as before, but there are no records of the victim's name, and Donald didn't really know or care to ask what their name was before he murdered them. In October of the same year, Donald met Daisy, which, once again, we don't know if it's her real name or not, but she was from Jacksonville, and she had been working in Myrtle Beach. Donald raped, tortured, and murdered Daisy in a very similar fashion as he did Angie. Donald would classify these killings as coastal kills. People that he did not know whom he killed in order to quench his killings of bothersomeness. As we know, these are often hitchhikers. Donald preferred female victims, but that didn't mean he would pass up an opportunity to kill a boy if he just happened upon one. By 1975, he wrote in his memoir, he wrote that he had found around 80 boys and girls, possibly more, along the highways in North Carolina, all of which he raped, tortured, and murdered. He considered these highway murders as weekend recreation. He would keep many of his victims alive for as long as possible, mutating them just enough to satisfy him for that day, but not enough to kill him, basically. He wanted to keep them around as long as he could in order to get as much gratification as he could from each victim. Oh, yeah. He would also cannibalize some of his victims while they were still alive.
What?
Forcing them to watch him eat some part of their body.
I don't think we've ever had a person do that. Mm-mm. I mean, cannibalize, yes, but not...
Not while they were awake?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Not when the person was alive, yeah. So when he finally did tire of the victims, Donald would rape them one more time and then kill them afterwards. In his book, where most of this information came from, called Final Truth, Donald claims to have committed these coastal kills about every 6 weeks. Something that is unusual among serial killers, and something that most likely made his crimes harder to connect and himself harder to catch, was that he killed victims using a variety of methods. He didn't have the same MO over and over. Mm-hmm. Sometimes he would stab them. Others he would suffocate, and sometimes he would just mutilate them so horribly that they would die from their injuries. So in his book, he claimed that he even forced some of his victims to participate in eating their own bodies. But it's not verified by any law enforcement. So that could just be a big old dirty lie. Donald had another category of killings in which he considered his serious murders. These were people he knew and murdered for personal reasons, unlike, you know, the random stranger murders of the coastal kills. The first victim in this kind of killing was his 15-year-old niece, Janice Kirby, and her 17-year-old friend, Patricia Ann Alsbrook. So on November 10th, 1970, Donald was driving down the road in town and he saw two girls outside. The girls, you know, had a little bit too much to drink and they were already on their way home, right? But, you know, doesn't mean that they deserved any bad things to happen to them. Mm-hmm. Besides getting in trouble for underage drinking, 15 and 17, come on, ladies. All right. Mm-mm. So Donald offered them a ride home from the bar, and they accepted.
Ugh. Good.
Well, it's the cousin. I mean, my cousin offers me a ride home. You know, you and I are walking down.
Yeah.
My cousin, I'd
but
take
we
a
know.
Ride.
We know. We know.
We wouldn't be walking anywhere, so it'd be fine.
Exactly.
So they finally figured out something was wrong when Donald drove them to his house instead of their respective homes. He stated that he was just doing this so they could have time to sober up.
Mm-hmm.
Shortly after arriving, Janice passed out from the alcohol. So Donald decided to flash his penis to Patricia, because that's what you do. You know, Patricia was horrified, right? As you would think. And she attempted to flee, but she didn't get very far. Donald pulled out a gun and ordered Patricia to sit in the bed and remain seated.
Mm.
While Patricia was sitting next to her friend, Donald attempted to sodomize an unconscious Janice. This, of course, woke Janice and she began to struggle. While Donald and Janice were struggling, Patricia grabbed a lamp and tried to hit Donald over the head. He fell over, clutching his head, and the girls ran out of the house. But Donald didn't lay down for very long. And soon Donald was chasing behind them as they were running down a dirt path into the woods. Donald once again shoved a gun in the girls' faces and ordered them back to the house. So back at the house, Donald forced Patricia to remove all of her clothes. And while she was doing so, Janice once again tried to escape, causing Donald to hit her and knock her out. These girls put up a heck of a fight, and they were not about to let this teeny tiny, itty bitty, little mean man kill them. And Patricia tried to stop Donald again, attempting to hit him, this time with a 2x6 board. She was unsuccessful and was then hit in the head by Donald's gun, which caused her to go unconscious. With both girls unconscious, he could finally control the situation. Donald then proceeded to handcuff both girls, rape them, and then beat them to death. Afterwards, he carried the bodies and put them in the trunk of his car and drove them to another location. And it's pretty unclear exactly where this location is. Here, he dumped Patricia's body into a septic tank and buried Janice in a shallow grave he dug just for her.
Mm-mm-mm.
After these murders, Donald went for a month before he had that urge to kill again. On December 18th, 13-year-old Margaret Edwards Peggy Catino, the daughter of State Senator James Catino, and granddaughter of the president of Clemson University, Dr. Robert Poole, goes missing. Or went missing, I should say. The police soon began questioning possible suspects, including Donald Pee-wee Gaskin. But he was released because he proved that he had an alibi, and an alibi was actually unknown, so we're not really sure how that is considered an alibi. But
right.
I digress. All right. 12 days later, Peggy's body is found in a wooded area off Highway 271, better known as the Manchester Forest by locals. The autopsy suggested that she died from blunt force trauma to the head, as well as strangulation. Her body was covered in cigarette burns, leading authorities to believe that she was tortured before being murdered. The decomposition of the body suggested she had been killed recently, and most likely within the last 5 days, suggesting that she had been kept captive for quite some time before her death. I would think if that was really Pee-wee, that she would have had knife wounds and such, don't you think?
Well, you said earlier he never. That's he didn't true. Always true. Do the same.
His you know? MOs were different, so yeah, very well likely she did get poor thing. A 39-year-old Swainsboro, Georgia man by the name of William Pierce, aka Junior, confessed to the murder in a dramatic turn of events. However, none of the evidence suggested that he actually was the killer. Yet he was sentenced to life in prison for Peggy's murder. Near the end of 1970, Donald's parole was finally completed. That meant that he could return to Florence County, where he married for the God knows how manyth time on New Year's Eve. At the time of their marriage, his wife was already 3 months pregnant, and in June of 1970, she gave birth to his son, Donald Lee Gaskins. He found work in a used car lot, where he helped rebuild cars and that would later be sold. He found his way back into stripping and repainting stolen cars, but these illegal acts did not quench his thirst for blood that he so desperately craved. Donald would continue to kill and would do so frequently, and by the end of 1971, he killed 11 more women. Donald had a cool-down period of about a year, and then after that, he described was being his most violent year in 1980. On March 29th, 1972, a black drug addicted, this is probably wrong, but this is what I'm going to say because I'm really unsure the terminology and I want to be as sensitive to it as possible, but it would be a trans woman, I'm assuming, named Martha Ann Dick, but also went by the name of Clyde. So I'm not for sure if she was, I'm not sure. But that's all the information I'm given right now. That's all I can say. That's all.
If that person was a transvestite, old term, I think today's term is cross-dresser.
Maybe it's cross-dresser.
If they're not really trans, as in, you know, changing genders.
Changing sexes, correct.
Yeah, yeah.
Genders, that's right. But I don't want to be...
I got you. Okay. I got you.
They went to visit Donald, and obviously they did this often. On this day, Martha pushed Donald a little too far. She told Donald that she was pregnant with his baby and joked about naming the baby Pee-wee Dix.
Oh.
Donald was very upset about this because he hated interracial babies and interracial relationships. But at the time, Donald played it cool and he acted as if nothing was wrong. But behind his facade, his bothersome feelings were rising. Donald told Martha to meet him sometime after 6 p.m. at the house, and there he would give her some kind of abortion pill that he had purchased and $5 for a blowjob.
Oh.
Sounds like a total catch right there. Who wouldn't want to show up? So
me.
Martha showed up and Donald gave her the pills, but however, the pills were not what they said they were. They were actually some kind of drug that knocked her out very quickly. And once Martha was passed out, Donald handcuffed her. And when she woke up, she tried to get away. And she then was met with a beating and a bottle of pills being forced down her throat. The huge number of pills that were forced down her throat caused her to overdose and killed her, which then Donald dumped her body in a drainage ditch. In June of 1972, Donald kidnapped a 16-year-old girl, Ann Culberson, from Atlanta. He took her to his old tenant house, where he held her for 96 hours. And while at the house, Donald tortured Ann for the entire 96 hours she was there, and then finally killed her. By killing her, this is how he did it, he smashed her head in from behind with a ball-peen hammer and buried her body in a grave he dug near where he buried his niece Janice. After this murder, Donald would become totally unhinged, right? This is all from the book, right? So this is what he's saying, that after this, I just became unhinged.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And then this is when his murder rate continued to rise. In October of 1973, Donald raped and killed 19-year-old Jackie Freeman. And this is confirmed. He did indeed delve into cannibalism, and he ate a portion of her calf. And this is the only officially confirmed incident of full-blown cannibalism of Pee-wee. Doing all this.
Let me interject this here because, and I can't remember if you and I have talked about this because I think we've got to be getting close to up there in numbers, right? But the cannibalism I don't understand it. Is it because the killer wants that person to be with them and stay with them forever? Is it an act of violence? What do you think?
From what I've read, it's to internalize the victim, like to keep them close to them.
Keep them with you, right?
Yeah, yeah, but I don't have that psych degree. All I know is it's insane. In December 1973, Doreen Dempsey was preparing to leave her house when Donald offered to drive her and her two-year-old daughter, Robin, to the bus station. Doreen was an unwed mother and was pregnant with the second child. Donald and Doreen had been friends for a very short time, so she believed that the offer was sincere and safe. That's why she accepted it. Mm-hmm. However, once they got on the road, Donald drove to a wooded area rather than towards Doreen's home. And under a thick brush and tree cover, Donald had all the privacy he needed to violently rape Doreen.
Ugh.
He then killed her while her little helpless daughter could do nothing more than cry. After killing Doreen, Gaskin decided that he wanted Robin too. Donald raped and murdered, allegedly with a hatchet to the head, the baby Robin in the same way he did her mother.
Ugh.
Donald's daughter, Shirley, would later say that her father, quote, could not resist raping the baby.
What?
He buried the two in the same grave. Yeah, I saw the quote. There's a documentary Mm-mm. on YouTube about Mm-mm. him, and it's nasty. In July of 1974, Donald raped and murdered two young unnamed boys. Later the same month, he killed 36-year-old Johnny Sellers and 22-year-old Jesse Ruth Judy after raping the both of them. Donald murdered them by tying them up with heavy chains before he threw them into a marsh, and then watched as they struggled for air as they drowned. Donald didn't leave the scene until the air bubbles stopped coming to the surface. In 1975, Donald murdered three young people whose vans had broken down on the highway. Among the three were two 20-year-old college girls and one male of about the same age. Donald forced the three to engage in group sex, and then he castrated the male and murdered the two females. Donald stole the van, and he was going to sell it, but it was dripping in blood, and so he needed some help to refurbish it. So he enlisted the help of his own friend, Walter Neely. I'm glad they're still in touch.
I can't believe how many people he...
Oh, he's said to have killed over 100 people. In February of the same year, Donald was asked to perform a murder-for-hire task, something that he was not yet familiar with. He was paid $1,500 to kill Silas Yates, a wealthy farmer from Florence County.
How much was he offered to pay?
$1,500. It was Susan Kipper, Yates's jealous and angry mistress, who hired Donald for the job. Of course, Donald accepted the offer, as he couldn't refuse good money for something he already does, which is murder.
Yeah, I mean, it's like us getting paid to watch Netflix.
I know. You mean you don't? You don't get paid? I do.
I'd be rich, I tell you.
There were more than just two players in this game, though, John Owens and John Powell. They were also enlisted to handle all correspondence and communication between Donald and Suzanne Kipper. Donald also got help from his friend Walter Neely's ex-wife, Diane Neely. On February 13th, Diane lured Silas out of his house by claiming that she had car problems and she needed help. So once Silas was seated in the car, Donald appeared with a gun and kidnapped Silas. Joined by John Owens, John Powell, and Diane Neely, Donald drove Silas to an unknown location, which the same general location as he buried the niece and her friend and all the other people. He murdered Silas while John Powell and John Owens watched, and together the three men buried the wealthy farmer's body. Not long after committing the murder for hire, Diane and her boyfriend, Avery Howard, decided they would try to blackmail Donald for $5,000. Basically, I won't tell the police that you killed mm-hmm. Silas Yates if you give us $5,000.
Wow.
Donald agreed to meet up with the couple, but shortly after meeting up, guess what happened?
I'm going to say they went missing. Hmm.
Well, Donald murdered them.
Well, yeah.
Right?
He's a peach like that.
And they were buried alongside Silas Yates. In September of 1975, a neighborhood girl by the name of Kim Gelkins caught Donald's attention. Kim was...
How old is she?
I was going to tell you, she's 13.
Yep. See, there you go. Mm-hmm. Yep.
Donald repeatedly made advances towards her, which Kim didn't like because Kim's a smart girl. Feeling rejected, Donald raped and murdered Kim.
Mm-hmm.
When October came...
Doesn't matter, though. He would have done it anyway, even if she didn't reject him.
Exactly. Yeah. But you know what? It doesn't seem like he killed any of his ex-lovers, though. To be quite honest.
That we know of. He said he... Well, yeah, I don't know.
It's not mentioned here, anyway. When October came, it proved to be no less violent. Two local men, 15-year-old Johnny Knight and 29-year-old Dennis Bellamy, burst into Gaskin's repair shop, attempting to rob him. Filled with rage, Donald soon tracked them down. He murdered the pair, and with the help of Walter Neely, they buried him alongside with all the other people that they've murdered. While there, Donald pointed out where he buried each person that he had murdered, you know, and then buried in that location.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, he trusted Walter more than anyone else. Around this time, the investigation into the disappearance of Ken Gelkins was underway and turning up leads, all of which were pointing to Donald Gaskins, of course. Authorities obtained a search warrant to search Donald's apartment and uncovered clothes that belonged to Kim. Donald was then indicted by a grand jury for contributing to the delinquency of a minor, and he was held without bail until trial. At this point, authorities found Walter Neely and began turning up the heat. Walter broke down, leading police to the burial site of several of Donald's victims. It is here that authorities found 8 bodies. Johnny Sellers, Jesse Ruth Judy, Avery Howard, Diane Neely, Johnny Knight, Dennis Bellamy, Doreen Dempsey, and her baby Robin. On April 27, 1976, the coroner confirmed Walter's story, and both Donald and Walter were charged with 8 counts of murder. On May 24, 1976, the trial for the 8 murders began. A short 4 days later, the jury found Donald Henry Gaskins guilty of murder in the first degree and sentenced to death by the electric chair. However, in November of the same year, his sentence was commuted to life with 7 consecutive life terms after the U.S. Supreme Court ruled that the death penalty was unconstitutional. By the end of April the following year, knowing that he would not face the death penalty, Donald took the stand and confessed to every murder he was accused of, along with a few additional ones that were unknown to law enforcement. I mean, what do you've got to lose, right? I mean,
wow.
He's already going away forever. In 1978, the death penalty was once again legal in South Carolina. However, this would not reverse sentences that had already been commuted from death to life due to the prior change in the law. But because of this stipulation, Donald felt that he had nothing to worry about. While incarcerated in South Carolina Correctional Institution, Donald was propositioned to murder a fellow death row inmate by the name of Rudolph Tyner for another inmate, Tony Simo. Tony and Donald were friends, but Donald agreed to kill for Tony, as he believed that he would not be able to receive the death penalty due to previous changes in the South Carolina law. Donald tried several times to kill Tyler, but was unsuccessful. He first tried lacing his food and drinks with poison, but when that didn't work out, he tried using explosives. Yes, explosives in prison. He got it. Donald rigged a device similar to a walkie-talkie in Tyner's cell and told him that this would allow him to communicate between cells, right? Donald mm-hmm. then told Tyner that he needed to hold the speaker to his ear at an agreed time so they could talk to each other. The speaker was filled with a C4 plastic explosive, at which at that certain time, Donald detonated the explosive from his cell, which killed Tyner as planned. And Donald said later, quote, "The last thing he heard was me laughing."
That's terrible.
Mm-hmm. So after the murder of Rudolph Tyler, Donald was once again put on trial for murder, right?
Mm-hmm.
This time, Pee-wee being a dummy, the death penalty had been reinstated, and he was once again sentenced to death. In a desperate attempt to stay out of the electric chair, Donald confessed to even more murders than before, including the murder of Margaret Peggy Catino. However, the state was unwilling to make the deal. Remember, that's how Bundy stayed being unfried.
That's
why
I said that I was surprised. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I guess they didn't want to put up with Pee-wee's shit anymore. As you know, with most criminals, they always brag about their numbers of how many people they've killed. But if Donald Henry Pee-wee Gaskins' number is to believe, if his claims are to believe, it would make him the most prolific serial killer in all American history. He would have committed between 100 and 110 murders. During the final months of his life, Donald decided to write an autobiography, and he wrote about the murders that he committed. And like we said before, the title of the book is called Final Truth, and it was published in 1993. And this is where Megan said that she used the book for pretty much this entire script. Donald dictated his thoughts into a tape recorder, to which an author by the name of Wilton Earle transcribed into the final book. Wilton also had many interviews with Gaskins, furthering the information that he gathered. The book is written exactly how Donald talked, so it's slightly hard to read, and because he was pretty much uneducated, and he was a good old Southern boy. So
yeah,
they have their own
school at age 11.
Right.
I can't even remember what you're learning at age 11.
Right. And I'm sure there's a bunch of Southern dialect and words that you can't understand.
Slang, probably.
On the day of his execution, Donald slashed his wrists because he was terrified of death of the electric chair. I'm guessing probably hoping to postpone the execution. However, the warden didn't let this happen. He had Donald's wrists stitched up, and then he was placed on the electric chair, just as scheduled. Donald's last words were, quote, "I let my lawyers talk for me. I'm ready to go." At 1:05 a.m. on September 6, 1991, Donald Henry Gaskins was pronounced dead. The only family present at his execution was his son, Donald Lee Gaskin. And that's it. Megan also says, that's all, folks. He's a pretty effed up dude.
That's cute, Megan. Megan, you did a great job. Very in-depth. There was a lot of that stuff. Like, as Jen was reading it, I was looking up stuff because I'm nosy. And I wanted to find out about the Boss Posse guy and stuff like that. And there's a lot of stuff that you had that wasn't online. Mm-hmm. So very good job.
She also said that there's a lot more detail to this story. And she encourages everybody to go read The Final Truth because it's a very interesting read.
I can't believe that he got away with that for that long.
For so long. You know? Well, I'm assuming he's traveling up and down the coastal highway, and since there wasn't really DNA or computers, you find a dead body that's mutilated on the side of the road in South Carolina, you're not going to know in North Carolina that when you find something almost the same way that it's connected, you know, back then. Now they know the system's in place.
I was just thinking about how many bodies went, how many murders went on, you know, before DNA went undetermined, undiscovered.
Exactly.
Unsolved.
Megan, we owe you a t-shirt. I know you already have one, but I'll be contacting you shortly to find out shirt color, size, all that kind of good things.
It's summer. You're going to have a plethora of colors.
Exactly. So,
looking good in your OTCP wear.
And if you out there, dear listener, have a case that you would like us to do and you want to write us up a script, send it in. You can send it to ourtruecrimepodcast@gmail.com. And we will try to read it as soon as possible, but things happen and gets pushed back. We've got another one coming your way, too, and we're hoping it's going to be a bonus for later this week, but it depends on if we can work it into our busy schedule. I do want to say our condolences go out to our dear friend, Andy. She's one of our very first listeners. She had to say goodbye to one of her best furry friends, little Jesse. So I'm very sorry, Andy, and it's heartbreaking.
Fly high on the Rainbow Bridge, buddy.
Little girl, be free. All those ham biscuits are out there for you. All right. So anyway.
Okay. Remember, lock your doors.
Keep passing by those open windows.
Bye-bye.
Love ya. And the first night he spent at the school, Donald was approached by Boss Poss. That's a fun name. Boss Poss. Yeah, like Boss Hog.
Yeah.
He was again given solidarity confinement. Nope.
Solidarity. Solidarity!
I know. Woo-hoo! So the job on the tobacco carn? Where am I saying carn? I'm thinking about Joe Exotic and his carny friends. That's why. I want to say Hazel Brazel, but I don't think that's right.
Well, yeah. Boss Poss.
Boss Poss. Hazel Brazant. once again came up with a plan to kill Hazel Brazel. We screw up. We go back to jail or reform school. We come out. Reform school. Sorry.
Wow.
Don't want our buddy commenting how I said the wrong word again. That keeps on going back into the reviews and adding all my mistakes in.
Oh, that's so cute.
I've got a crush on you.
Best part is that you know
Sweetie
that.
Sweetie pie.
He's like paying attention. That's the best part. You know?
At least he's reading it. Thanks for listening. All right.
You put this in the blooper because this is terrible, but Jen, he's closer to the ground, so it probably didn't hurt as bad. It's because, you know, like
that's
little,
true.
Little kids when they fall, because it's only like, you know, 18 inches a fall for them versus us.
That's just because kids are pretty much made of rubber when they're little. And we don't really know if that's her real name or not.
Angie! Oh, Angie!
A 39-year-old Swainsboro man. A 39-year-old. Is it right? Swainsboro! Swainsboro!
Yeah.
Reminds me of. A 39-year-old Swainsboro, Georgia man by the name of William Pierce, a.k.a. Junior. Sorry.
Junior and Pee Wee.
Yeah.
Aw.
And 22-year-old Jethie Ruth Judith. Or, yeah, CIMO, C-I-M-O. I'm going to say CIMO.
C-I-C-I-C-M-O, C-I-C-M-O, and CIMO was his name.
C-E-M-O, yeah.